man. This aircon is racist.
I've never ever been a spy.
Can the VBS bank loot?
The problem is that Pinky.
I'll never subject myself to whiteness.
I'm listening.
Can you have consistency, Honorable Chair?
Corruption was an Olympic sport. They will always win gold.
This is not a shit.
At arms, can you please come
on the
in?
Point of order.
Greetings and salutations. Welcome to another edition of Sunday Times Politics Weekly. With me, Amil Amrao. We're here in the studio with my Sunday Times colleagues, Apiwe de Klerk, Zimasa Matewane, and Kwanita Hunter. Thank you all so much for joining me in studio this week, and thank you for everyone who's listening out there. We obviously welcome your support. The more listeners, the better for us. We really enjoy interacting with you on Twitter as well. So don't forget, when you're done listening to our podcast this week, please interact with us on Twitter at hashtag STPoliticsWeekly. You can also find our podcasts on the Times Live website under the Opinions and Analysis page. We'll be sharing these links all over social media if you guys want to find us there. Anyway, let's get straight into it with our first section, The Good, The Bad, and The Newsworthy. And for this week, we thought we would talk about sex. Well, not really sex. Not really sex, but
it's
more
going
about...
Not what I signed up
for. But more about what EFF leader Julius Malema said over the weekend at the Vodacom Durban in July. Spectacular event, which is the Durban July, where we see politicians masquerading in their expensive suits, interacting with the big businessmen of the country, and we see a different side to them. I think for the one time in the year, we actually get to see the side rather than the Sona red carpet, where they still can't say much. But yeah, at this gathering, let's call it gathering here, at an after party, Julius Malema made a little statement. Looked like a drunken statement to me, but let's not pass any allegations here. He said, and he told the crowd, who were obviously in a bit of a party mood, go to your rooms and have sex. Take your booze with you. Your women are waiting for you. Stop sleeping here. Now, this was obviously a very jovial setting, right?
Yeah.
But now we're talking about a senior politician in South Africa, a leader of one of the biggest parties in the country who commanded massive influence across a lot of his voters. And you know, Zimasa, what the EFF's voters and supporters are like. They're diehard fans of Julius.
Yeah, no, of course.
Nothing he could ever do would be wrong in their eyes. So now you're commanding such influence. And I just want to use this as a case study almost. Because we see politicians in their sort of private lives saying one thing and with a very different personality and tone. And then we watch them in parliament and we watch them at rallies. And it's very different. It's a very different message and a very different tone. Should there be a line between these two? Because for me personally, I would love to see Julia speaking like this in parliament. I would love to see people, politicians be themselves so that we can vote for the person that they truly are rather than this facade that they normally put up. What do you guys think?
I think that it was the right time and place. It was a fun, and I think Julius wanted to prove a point, especially considering the media attention about this hypocritical life that him and the other EFF leaders have been, you know, just the commentary about it. So I think going to the Durban July for him was like a serious show of like, I will show you that I'm going to have fun. Posted pictures of his amazing suit. That was a really good suit.
Yeah.
And did Instagram lives of him drinking his bubbly and whatever he was drinking, DJ'd a little bit. I think he really went there to let his hair down. And I think in South Africa, we don't have like an American type of culture that more people relate to politicians when they are like this than when they are just, you know, standing from a pulpit and preaching.
Yes.
So, like, for this, it was like, oh, he's a normal human being. Mm. He has fun, he drinks, he parties like everyone else.
I would actually like to see more politicians having fun and, you know, letting their guard down and saying whatever it is that they want to say so that we can sort of, like, get to know them better. Mm.
Talk Cabana. About...
Yeah, I know, around January 8th, Cubana is what's happening.
But guys, do you think that this distinction should exist where we see a a persona like Julius Malema in one state, and then in a different setting we see him in a different state saying something different. Because some would argue that it's not the message of his party, or his it's convoluting the messages of the party with his own messages. Where do we go from there?
Okay, so Judas has been consistent with encouraging people to have sex and have more kids, even during the campaign. Yes. This is something that he advocated a lot. So I think that when you're at work, you are serious. There are things that you can say at work. There are things that you can't say at work. Even you, Amil, when you're at Cubana on Saturday,
this is dancing,
on top of a table. You say whatever you want.
Somebody knows some stories.
Why was I not invited?
Anyway, but that's different. I mean, in the private sector, obviously, but now you're a public persona. Should different rules apply to you?
But I don't think there's anything contradictory about. I really don't, and I think that, let's give an example. You know the Mduduzi Manana,
yes,
hitting a woman, right? Like for me, it just that scenario. He was out partying and that went wrong and whatever. For me, that's now inconsistent with your office. You understand what I'm saying?
Because you committed a crime.
You committed a crime, right? Mm. But going out and having a party and having... I mean, there's a whole lot of other conversations that you can have about conspicuous consumption in South Africa, given the state of the economy, given your politics. All of that can happen. But I don't think that... I don't think that another conversation can be had about Julius's hypocrisy or his, the whole thing about, oh, you preach one thing in parliament and you wear fancy suits to Durban July and you wear red overalls in parliament. Mm. I feel like that point is exhausted, and whoever cared enough to accept that point has accepted that point.
Yeah.
But also, I want to agree with Kanita regarding that. I mean, the whole thing was cheap politicking, that they were going to wear suits. But when they go into a serious conversation to say, no, the reason why we wear these is because we sympathize with these people and whatnot. Now, okay, so do we then expect them to go wearing red overalls everywhere they go? We know how much MPs get paid. So what do we want them to do with the money that they get paid? Should they stake it up until they get kicked out of parliament and then go live a luxurious life when they are no longer public reps? I don't know. I mean, it's a very tricky conversation. We know who Julius is. It's well documented. I don't think he would have then changed overnight when he got kicked out of the ANC Youth League. His followers follow him, knowing very well who the person he is, his lifestyle and all of that. They know about Ratanang Trust, and they know about Ratanang the son as well. they follow him on Instagram, and Q is a big fan on Instagram.
I seriously love his Instagram lives. I won't lie.
You know what I liked about Julius and his sex video.
Sex video. Yeah,
is that having been at the Durban July before, I've seen politicians who behave like politicians at Groove.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make sense to me. It looks fake. So you get there, you look like you're an honorable member at a marquee where people are doing Ivosh.
Yeah.
You don't belong there. Don't go there. Julius goes there.
Yeah.
He makes things happen. He makes people excited. People go and have sex and do whatever they want to do. It's fun. Why he was there.
I guess that is the allure that is Julius Malema, I guess.
But I think this, it really makes us have like a more, I think we need to start having a bit more mature conversation about these kind of inconsistencies or whatever. Like, for me, there was nothing offensive about that video. Like, like the man was drunk. I'll say the man was drunk. I saw the Instagram live video when they were
when he was drinking.
But it's just that what happens is you have this stupid conversation. And you know, Zimasa, you remember some weeks ago, or even some months ago, I wrote that story about Julius having a membership at a very elite polo club. And something was unsettling about the story to me as a person who wrote the story, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, so what? But then the argument was made at the time to say, okay, this is exactly what he fights against, that whole exclusivity. That makes no sense. Also, it was a light.
The elitism.
Yeah. So it was a light story. It was a fun story. He laughed at it. Fine, whatever. But also, I feel like that conversation, that whole, oh, look at Julius. Julius is acting like a celebrity, or Julius is a celebrity.
Yeah, of course.
And if his followers don't see it, they don't see it.
Well, I guess it'll be up to the EFF supporters to make up their own minds. We'll be back after the quick break when we get into the story of the week.
Join me, Paul Ash, in a beautiful soundscape as we explore the world in the Sunday Times Travel Podcast. Find it at sundaytimes.co.za.
To advertise on the Sunday Times Politics Weekly Podcast, email us at smiths@tisoblackstar.co.za. That's smiths@tisoblackstar.co.za. Okay, welcome back. Now, the story of the week can be none other than our ambassador to the Netherlands, Bruce Kolwane, who appeared before the state capture inquiry this week and basically kept up to his title. He remained true to his prescribed title as the Waterkloof Fall Guy back in 2013 when the Guptas landed that private Jet Airways plane at the Waterkloof Air Force Base. That's just outside Pretoria, right? So, if you guys don't know, back in 2013, before the Guptas' massive Sun City wedding, they had landed about 80 to 100 guests at the restricted military airbase. Obviously, they weren't allowed to as civilians, but they, through some explanation that we still don't have properly, were allowed to land this jet. And this was the first sort of indication that the Guptas had a massive influence over the state. Now, Kolwane at the time, he was charged. He was under disciplinary action from Durco. At the time, he was charged on three charges, and he pleaded guilty to all of them. Just for some background, the first charge alleged that he abused his diplomatic channels and took it upon himself to facilitate the landing for the Guptas. It's also alleged that he spoke directly to the command post at Waterkloof and stated that Indian ministers will be arriving on the flight when this was not the case. He was also accused, and this is important, of dropping the names, in inverted commas, of former President Jacob Zuma.
Number one.
As referred to in some call recordings that an investigation then found. The Defense Minister, Nosiviwe Mapisa Nakula, and then Transport Minister Ben Martins. Now, this was done apparently in an effort to pressurize the command post to issue the clearance for the landing to take place. He was also accused of misrepresenting facts when he told the command center flight post officer Thabo Ncisi, who was in charge of permitting the landing at the time, that this was a unique case that had to be pushed through. The third charge alleged that he compromised processes and procedures at Durco because the department had not recommended or knew that the flight was coming in. So he pleaded guilty to all those charges back
and then.
He got the final written warning.
He got a final written warning. No, he was suspended. And then President Jacob Zuma at the time gave him this highly lucrative ambassadorial post in the Netherlands. Remember, at the time, he was the chief of protocol, if I'm not mistaken, for South Africa when he was suspended.
In light of his testimony now at the Zondo Commission, he should be recalled.
I think a lot of people are actually saying there's no way
you could have someone who says, amongst other reasons why he did that, he wanted to impress the High Commissioner.
Indian High Commission.
And also, he says, after that, he has then since facilitated business meetings for the Guptas as our ambassador in Netherlands. Clearly, this guy is still serving the people that he was serving before he was posted in that. Why is he not recalled?
So basically, he can sell us to impress some guy in India.
But
and then continue to while he's supposed to be advancing our interests as a country,
yeah.
continue to advance the interests of the Guptas, who are they fugitive? Can we call them fugitives?
Yes.
They are fugitive to the state capture process. They are not coming here.
So let me tell you a story.
He's still, they must recall that guy.
In 2015, Rajeni Monsami, our colleague and I, we went to the Netherlands, right? And we went to The Hague. And then we were he invited us for dinner at a restaurant.
Oh, so sounds like a Kafka story.
so we go to this restaurant, and you know, we're talking and whatever. And I remember there was delicious food there, and then not curry, but and then Ranjani starts the conversation to say, "So what happened? Like, you know, tell us." And you know, I probed and she probed it. And he was like, "What happened at the Waterkloof landing will come with me to my grave. No one will ever know whatever happened there." That's literally what he said. There are some things you did in a job as a head of state protocol, which is a very powerful job.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, like, there's just some things people will never know. And so Ranjani joked and said, "Well, his grave is parked out."
But the thing is, he's still taking it to his grave,
exactly,
because his testimony
exactly.
was absolute rubbish. Let me break it down for you guys here. Because on Monday, when he first appeared before the commission, he said that he instructed Ntsisi, who was in charge of authorizing the landing, to process the flight application with the understanding that the Indian High Commission had submitted all the required documentation for the landing to take place. But now, on Tuesday, after the commission played the recordings, some core recordings between him, Ntsisi, and other members of the senior members of the defense force, he says that no, he felt pressured. He pressured Ntsisi because he felt the need to appease the Indian High Commissioner, who at the time was Virendra Gupta. There's no link to the family here, even though they have the same surname. But he changed his tune around completely. Then he started admitting to all the charges. First, he was very defensive on Monday, saying that no, it was his PA's fault when she sent an email authorizing the flight. She misunderstood him. That was not his intention. There was a misunderstanding between the two of them. Maybe he didn't communicate it properly. And then on Tuesday, he comes back. Let me quote him here on Tuesday. "I pleaded administrative negligence because the impression that had been created was that there had not been any application, and I was informed by the Indian High Commissioner that he had applied. And he was of the assumption," he says, "that all was done properly and by the book. I did agree that I erred in that." And then he goes on, and then the big part of the testimony was that he used the names of President Jacob Zuma, the Minister of Transport, and the Minister of Defense when he was pressurizing these senior officials. He was basically saying, "Hold up, number one has authorized this. The Minister of Defense knows about this. The Minister of Transport knows about this." And he used these names to sort of get all the other senior officials to get the flight to land. Now he says, no, he only did that to get the job done, to authorize. He was not acting under anybody's instructions. The Minister of Defense didn't know about it. The Minister of Transport didn't know. And especially President Jacob Zuma did not know about it. He just used their names in order to pressurize those officials.
I don't believe that.
He thinks who are in grade R. That
I don't believe that. But what I don't understand is why is he protecting number one? Because he has nothing to gain from number one anymore.
Because he's number zero.
How do you know?
He's number zero.
How do you know? Maybe he has gained something already.
So this is... Okay. Without sounding like a conspiracy theorist, right? What you know for sure is that the Guptas were at the height of their might at the time.
Yeah.
And you know that the president didn't believe there was anything wrong with the Waterkloof landing. Right?
Yeah.
So, okay, what we also know is that Jacob Zuma doesn't leave his handprints on anything.
Yeah, no.
That is true.
Never.
So you won't find his handprints.
Mm-hmm.
But, and then you also know that the chief of state protocol works immensely close with the president.
Yes.
Because this is the person, like, so you know when Ramaphosa arrives at an event, right?
Mm.
The chief of state protocol has already done everything to arrange the protocol for the president. Mm. When you go on heads of state, they go with, they're the ones that introduce Putin, and you know that's the job of the head of. It's a really powerful position, right? If you can accept bribes, I'm just using that as an example. I'm not saying anyone accepted bribes, but you can, a head of state, you have all the access to introduce people to the president more than anyone else, especially on foreign travel, right? So there's no way they didn't have a relationship, Zuma and Bruce Kobane, right? So Zuma may not have told him, do 1, 2, 3, because he was so ahead of the game that he never left his fingerprints on anything. But the reality of it is, why is an official at Durco, what is it that allowed him, even to say if you accept his version, what is it that he believed that this is a very powerful family? And if I disagree, just if you take him on his account, how bad were things were at the time that it was, this guy was like, I can't disobey these people, or I can't stand up against, I must enable them, because enabling them will get me to where I want.
Yeah,
and I think the big
connecting
question,
the dots.
We're not connecting the dots.
In Pravin Gordhan's voice.
The one thing I was very surprised about personally was that the commission, or the deputy chief justice, Raymond Zondo, did not ask Kobane, okay, fine, you drop these names in. Obviously, and Kobane admitted that it must have caused them serious reputational damage mentioning their names. It must have. Okay, that's what he says. But then, so you've dropped the president's name, you've caused him reputational damage, people are now asking questions about the president, but then he rewards you with an ambassadorial post. Why was that question not asked? And Kobane said that I didn't have he said he was too ashamed to speak to the president afterwards. He said he hasn't spoken to the president since the plane landed. But the thing is, then who gave you your job? Who told you about your job?
No.
How does it work? But
I can believe that, right? I can. That's not something outrageous to me, because you can become an ambassador without the president's.
Okay,
to
cool.
You.
But then why would the president reward him with that job?
Because that
and
was
not just
Jacob,
leave him on suspension.
That was Jacob Zuma's modus operandi, and once he you have served his interest and he has rewarded you, he can forget about
yes,
you.
But surely that question should have been asked.
Absolutely, right? Absolutely.
That was an important question.
The is president it? Needs but to answer that question. The former president needs to answer that question.
Yeah, also,
because
I mean,
Bruce,
the guy was being disciplined.
Yeah, and he was suspended.
For that incident. And you turn around and reward him with that position. Why? I mean, if you were so offended that he dropped your name, I remember when this investigation was going on
with the JCPS cluster.
Yes, Luthuli House had to comment as well.
Yes,
and I think it was Gwede who was speaking there. That they
and Jackson
and Jackson. Yeah, they were so angry at the fact that people are name dropping, misusing the name of the president.
Yeah.
So Gwede was that angry. Jackson was that angry on
Jackson Mthembu,
no? Yeah, Jackson Mthembu was that angry on behalf of then President Jacob Zuma, but Jacob Zuma was not angry. So why is he not angry about
the
this
person
thing?
The person who name dropped me, I'm going to reward him now.
Yeah.
No, but
can I tell you something? Now, that incident, the Vajkluv incident. Remember, I was at the belly of the beast at the time, right? For those who know, right? But it really was what you needed to exemplify, or to like almost become that an example of the type of influence they had. And remember, by 2013, the influence was not around for that long.
Mm.
They only started getting real muscle, if you look at the emails, if you look at the capture, 2012.
Yeah.
So 2013, boom, you do this thing. And then it just gets worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. And I think that people like Bruce Kobane, people like, you know, other people, maybe the ministers that were involved at the time, your Ben Martins, etc., their decisions to protect, let's not say who, but to not speak out at that time, enabled the decimation of the state that came afterwards. That was that was, we could get away with it. So screw everyone.
Yeah, if you did it once, you can did it again.
I can also did it.
But the scary part is that Kumane was sort of the centerpiece around this whole thing, and everybody was sort of relying on his testimony to sort of blow the lid on the entire Waterkloof landing. And that's not the case. There's nobody else to go to because the commission has already heard all the evidence from all the senior officials who had followed his instruction and approved the flight. And the big gap was then Kolwonen, whose instructions he was acting on. And now I guess, will we ever know is the big question to ask.
Can I ask, is the commission empowered to then recommend that further action be taken against Kolwonen?
Yeah.
Because if they do that, then if it goes the legal route, would he want to really go to the grave with this one?
But you see what happens, and this is a very important discussion, Amir, is that so many people have weighed their odds when it comes to this commission and realize, this is not serious. Mm. And so if there was a real chance that Bruce Kolwane would have been personally affected, what's the worst thing that's going to happen to him? He already has a bad name. What is the worst thing? If you carry on lying here under oath, I mean, really, what is going to happen to him? He's sitting there thinking, the worst that's going to happen to me is that I might lose my job. And anyways, my posting cycle was going to come to an end now. Anyways, I've already made 8 million rand from the state or whatever million. You understand?
It's time to
I have this cushion. I've already bought my house. My house is paid up. My cars are paid. So there's no incentive at this commission for people
to tell the truth.
Unless you are like I suppose, you know, the whistleblowers, etc., etc. But I'm saying, when you are subpoenaed, there's no precedent that has been set to say, I'm going to go down like he went down. You know, like when number one went down, I'm number 15 and I'm also going down.
The only person that went down, shame on Tantane.
And that's
it. For the guy. And even him himself, his thing didn't even involve lying under oath. He was just speaking to a poor journalist. And then he comes here and tells us the truth, and then boom.
And then, like now this PG finding, you know, but we'll get to PG, right?
We'll get to PG.
But it's the reality of it is that the enforcers of state capture are not afraid of this.
No, of course not.
Inquiry. Of course not. As they ought to have been. Maybe they were at the beginning. But now, people are just like tired of hearing Grizzly's nonsense and this one's nonsense. It's like, so what? You came and you understand? Mm. And they know that the state has been, the criminal justice system has been dismantled.
Yeah.
So what's going to happen? Shamila Batoi is going to charge you. And then, nothing's going to happen. Then you're going to be back into power. That's exactly what, if I'm a Zuma person that was a recipient of state or an enforcer of state capture, I'm just thinking, by the time she charges me and this man goes to court, it will be NGC, it will be next one. I'll use politics, you understand?
Exactly.
I'll win the next round and then I'm fine.
Mm. Well, that's a sad state of affairs, I guess, because the thing is, we're never going to get closure on the Waterkloof matter, and we'll have to wait until the Deputy of Justice actually comes out with the report and see what he recommends, and that's going to be... Jeez, I can't even tell you when that's going
to
be.
I thought you were going to say you have to wait until Jesus comes.
But anyway, we're going to take another quick break, and when we get back, we're going to get into our last segment where we're going to tell you what to expect when you're unsuspecting. Join us after the break.
Young people are making their mark. Get up.
Tune into the Sebenza Live Behind the Hustle podcast every Tuesday to find out more about what fascinating careers are out there. You can find us on the Sowetan Live website,
or you can follow us on Twitter on Sebenza Live.
Sebenza boy.
Sebenza girl.
Sebenza.
Yavamdenam.
To advertise on the Sunday Times Politics Weekly podcast, email us at smiths@tisoblackstar.co.za. That's smiths@tisoblackstar.co.za. Next week, The former president, Jacob Zuma himself, will be appearing before the state capture inquiry. Now, I use the word appearing because that's the words his lawyers used when they wrote back to the commission saying that he will comply. But they didn't use the word testify. So we don't really know exactly what's going to happen next week. All we know is that between the 15th and the 19th, the commission has set down dates for Zuma to appear and answer questions against allegations that have been put down. And there's a lot of allegations, guys. I mean, this went back all the way to the beginning of the commission when Barbara Hogan was testifying about how the then president influenced her to appoint various CEOs at various parastatals, how he sort of put pressure to make certain deals happen. That went on to, if I remember correctly, it then went on to Fakey, who said that Zuma had introduced her to the Gupta family and that they had offered her the deal to be public enterprises minister. There were a whole bunch of other allegations against Zuma. Agrizi said that Zuma was on their payroll, 300,000 rand a month, I think it was. Yeah, there was Ramesh Lodi. There's a whole lot that Zuma has to answer for next week. Whether he will answer or not is a different story. Kwanita, you know, you've been covering Zuma for a long time over your career. And this approach that Zuma has of delaying and delaying and delaying, we've seen it happen in court over the arms deal case. We've seen it happen over the state capture, the original public protector's report in state capture, Tuli Madonsela's report. We've seen this delaying tactic over and over and over these years. Do you think that we're actually going to finally get an official answer from the president next week as to what happened over his tenure?
If Jacob Zuma, if I would say his middle name if I could pronounce it, if he comes to 16 Empire Road and answers questions about what was raised here, I'm buying everyone in this room lunch.
It has been recorded. It's
my point made.
Do it for me, Msholozi. Do it for me.
Amil, what are his options? Can he come here and say nothing?
Yeah.
So he can come here and say nothing. He can come here and have his lawyers argue why the commission is being biased towards them. He can come here and say that I don't know anything. I don't recall this. I don't recall that. I don't know what you're talking about. You're being biased to me. They could basically throw the entire process off if they wanted to and argue that he's being treated unfairly, because they've already started to argue in their letters.
Yeah. But that's what they always do.
Yes. Yes. So it seems that Zuma's strategy is to become the victim here before the commission. And that's where we start to see this process start to develop, where you certify yourself as the victim and then start to delay the entire process until something happens in your favor.
And then you can say something outside of court that the State Capture Commission has found nothing against Zuma. It has. Serious findings. What Ngwakoro Matlori alone has said to this commission is enough to put another president away.
Yeah.
If we had a well-functioning democracy or well-functioning criminal justice system. So the thing is, this gives him ammunition for to fight back politically instead of going and actually subjecting yourself. And I think it's something that he's going to want to delay until he can't anymore, as we've seen him do hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times in his presidency.
The thing is, you can't really... I'm surprised to see how long he's been delaying this, because he wanted questions from the commission. He wanted to know. Okay, are you going to ask me this question? This question. Give me a list of questions. I'll prepare my responses and I'll come and give it to you. That's what his plan was. But the thing is, how the commission works is the moment your name is mentioned in the commission, they issue you with a notice, a 3.3 notice, saying that your name has been mentioned by this person. Respond. How do you respond? Yeah. That technically is a question. Here's the allegation. How do you respond? That's the question. So it's not like he hasn't been getting the questions. It's just been a different form. So now saying that the commission is treating him unfairly, it's a totally different matter. It's totally untrue, actually.
But he did the exact same thing with Tuli Madonsela to say, no, she didn't give me the questions beforehand. Then she sends the questions. Then it was, I needed a few months to respond to it. When it was yes or no questions, remember?
Yeah, I remember.
So, Amil, what you're saying basically is that despite these serious allegations that have been made against our former president, he can come and say nothing and that's the end of it.
Exactly. And all they have to say is, well, Zuma didn't respond to the allegations.
And nothing will happen to him.
Nothing will happen to him.
Unless of course
the Zimosa's looking so shocked.
What's the point of the commission, guys?
but if he goes, the thing about it though is he has to be careful, because if he doesn't respond to those questions openly and as honestly as possible, when he feels that he really did nothing wrong, the likelihood is that then there's a trend that this guy is not answering or responding to any of these questions. So if someone is not responding or answering, and people are making these allegations and they are under oath, the likelihood is that the commission then should be compelled to say, part of our findings that this guy is the one who should be answering for this and this and this and that. And if you want to recommend, you must recommend this course of action.
Well, the thing
is, it may disadvantage him in a way.
Exactly. You know, the commission will find against him because he hasn't provided an alternative facts.
And in the example for that, you know this, I mean, in the Nugent report, remember the Nugent report, is that Tom Muyale didn't want to go and answer the questions. He didn't want to. Same, very similar scenario. And you know, they have the same legal team.
He was saying that they were biased against him.
They just fought the process to say this is biased, you know. So then Judge Nugent made findings adversely against him. And the funny thing is that Muyale never challenged the report on to court. So what you do is you take a political process. I'm a victim, where people actually don't know about the real nitty-gritty of the whole process, to say, no, that Nugent report is bogus, I was not even called there. Meanwhile, you were called there. You made a completely different argument about raising the fact that the one of the lawyers in the Nugent Commission used to once long ago work with Ramaphosa. Yeah. You know what I mean? So it's a very similar tactic, and I think it's important for us as journalists to actually point this out. Oh, we've seen this before. We've seen it in the spy tapes. We've seen it in state capture. We've seen it in Kandla. We've seen it over and over and over again.
But anyway, that's for next week. So I guess we're going to have a massive, explosively good podcast next week after the president. Well, he'll be in the midst of his testimony, hopefully, when we get back to you guys next week. But thank you so much for joining me in the studio, guys. And thank you for everyone who's listening. We're going to catch you guys next week in the midst of Zuma's testimony, should he come and should he testify at least. And join us then. Thank you so much and have a good week.